All right. This is Regina Kong with the Hobbit Hole Oral History Project. Today I'm with Greg Howe on July 9th, 2019, at his home in Gustavus. So let's begin just by having you restate your name and telling me a little bit about where you were born.
Hi, my name is Greg Howe. I was born in Asheville, North Carolina, where my father was a ranger on the Blue Ridge Parkway, which was his career until he retired here in Gustavus. I was born in North Carolina, and I spent the first 6 years of my life in North Carolina. And then my father was applied to go to Yellowstone Park, and was accepted there, or got his job in Yellowstone Park as the Canyon District Ranger in the summer times, and then in the wintertime Canyon of course was closed, so we were in Mammoth. And should I go on with
this is life? This is your narration.
So we lived in Yellowstone during what I guess would be my formative years, from the time I was six through eighth grade in school. And then he became the park biologist in Yellowstone, was his final position there. And things got politically active in Yellowstone at the time with, in his position as a park biologist, with elk reduction and buffalo management and the possibility of introducing wolves and all those things. Anyhow, he decided it was time to move on, and he put down Alaska as where he wanted to go next, and he was offered the position of superintendent of Glacier Bay National Monument at the time and Sitka National Monument at the time. And he took the job and came here, and we lived in Juneau, and he spent his time between the two national monuments and most of his time in Glacier Bay because he preferred it here. And I had a great childhood growing up in Yellowstone. I spent my summers in the backcountry fishing and backpacking. We wanted to buy a motorcycle when we were kids, but our parents weren't up for that, so we got a donkey instead. And me and my childhood friends spent our summers in the backcountry of Yellowstone with the donkey packing our stuff and hiking into various remote locations to go fishing and exploring, etc.
Did you have siblings?
I have one sibling, my brother Fred Howe, who was born in Mississippi when my father was on the Natchez Trace Parkway, and he started his career in Isle Royale in Maine after he got out of the military.
Younger or older?
Older.
Older.
He's 3 years older. Mm-hmm. Three and a half.
And then what was your relationship with him like growing up?
It was always been pretty good. I wouldn't say we were like close, but we've always been, you know, we've always got along well. We're each different people, and that's normal.
How would you?
I would describe him as not as social as I am. Other than that, I suppose we have some similar traits. He's always been into fishing since he was a little boy, and tying flies, and he still ties flies and still does a lot of fly fishing, and that's been his main interest in life, it seems. Whereas fishing for me was okay when we were kids. I loved to do it. And then, of course, we both became commercial fishermen, more involved with commercial fishing and so on and so forth, since it was our lifeblood. so to speak. And Brother Fred got a degree in, I believe, fisheries biology and something else from the University of Alaska, and worked for Fish and Game for a few years. And I also went to college at the university and pursuing a degree in biology. But the purchase of the Hobbit Hole came along before I finished my schooling, and I never went back.
So tell me more about coming to Alaska for the first time with your family.
Well, coming from Yellowstone, the big sky country where it's beautiful and sunny all the time, it was a pretty dramatic change to come to Southeast Alaska rainforest and not having any friends or anything when we first arrived was pretty, I would say, probably depressing at the time, although I don't remember it being particularly depressing.
How old were you again?
Well, I was just finished my freshman year in high school, so I was whatever that makes you, 14,
yeah,
something like that. But I got to know some friends, and we got a boat and started going fishing and started doing the things you do in Southeast Alaska, and so things got better pretty fast. And the year we moved to Alaska was the first year that the Glacier Bay Lodge was open. And I guess it must have been the second summer that we came out with our cabin cruiser, and they decided it was all right if I took people out fishing as long as I didn't charge them, and they just tipped me without having proper Coast Guard license. But then they decided that that probably wasn't legal and that I couldn't do that. So that was a short career in the charter business, and I ended up being the deckhand on the Seacrest, which was the first day boat to go up the bay from the lodge, and that's what I did that summer. And then in the evenings I worked in the kitchen at the lodge, making crab salads and washing pots and pans were my chores.
So this is the lodge at Glacier Bay?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And this is 1966 is the first year that it opened.
And who were the people who were coming to the lodge?
Just the same people that are coming now, tourists from all over the world, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. And so you started working there in high school?
Mm-hmm. I started working there in high school in the summer, and that was the I can't remember if it was the first summer we were here or the second summer we were here. And that was the only summer that I did that. And then after that, I worked at Juneau Cold Storage while I was going to college. And Paul Johnson, whose father was a manager of Juneau Cold Storage at the time, was a good buddy of mine in high school. And he was financed to buy a tender, which was the old Forester, which was a mail boat here in Southeast Alaska for many years. And he was buying fish, and we're trying to buy fish in Lynn Canal, gillnet fish, and he wasn't getting very many fish because he was the new guy on the block. And then Art, whose last name I can't remember, who had the Fern too, who was the primary trollfish buyer, and Icy Straits in particular, and a little bit in Cross Sound, had a heart attack, so it opened up a position for somebody else to move into, and he moved into it and asked me to come and be his deckhand. So I left the fish house, the cold storage, where I worked on the freezer crew, and deckhanded for him that first summer, and then for a couple of summers after that as his operation in Elephant Cove expanded, and he bought property there and put in a buying station and a store and so on and so forth. And then during that period, Paul Johnson and a friend of mine, Steve Stewart, Judge Thomas B. Stewart's son, or one of his many children, took a trip with Gildersleeve, who used to be one of the bush pilots here in southeast Alaska, and we wanted to go up to the Lituya Bay and hike the coast from Lituya Bay up to a mining camp there below Cape Fairweather, just for an expedition. And when we were on that expedition, we flew over the Hobbit Hole, and as I like to say, it was one of those Jesus kinds of days, with the big cumulus clouds and the sun shining down through the clouds, and this beam of sun shining right down on the Hobbit Hole as we flew over at 2,000 or 3,000 feet. And I said to myself, boy, that's a neat spot. And up until that time, I had fantasized about building a log cabin here in Gustavus, and I was trying to get a permit from the state to cut logs to build my log cabin, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I was just out of high school, so things weren't moving very fast. But I saw that spot, and I was intrigued by it, and came home and found out that it was for sale in the Juneau real estate column, and had been for several years. And I have since found or met people that had thought about buying it and never, you know, just hadn't gotten it together. Anyhow, after we got back from our beach hike up the trip, we got in our family sailboat, my brother Fred and Jimmy Mahan, who used to work at K2 for many years, and who I went to college with in Fairbanks, sailed out here on our sailed to the Hobbit Hole on our family sailboat and tied up at the pilings out front and went into the beach, and there were dishes in the cupboards, linens in the cabinets. The warehouse was full of tools, chainsaws. There was a diesel generator and a gas generator and all these things. It was like, wow, we're ready to go.
So these are from the people who are living there?
Well, there was nobody living there at the time. Mm-hmm. It was for sale by the people, by a couple who had bought it from Doug and Flo Freed, who had bought it from the Fox Farmers. Mm-hmm. So the Fox Farmers started in the early 1900s, the teens, something like that. And then when the Great Depression came and the price of fur went down to nothing, then they put it up for sale. And as we understand it, there were two couples that started the Fox Farm on the island, and the wives did not get along, so they patented a second piece of property in Indian Cove, and then they ran the whole island as a fox farm and had feeding stations all around the island where they would feed the foxes, and then those feeding stations turned into live traps when the pelts were prime, and then they'd go pop them on the head and skin the furs and take them out. And there are still some stretching boards, or at least there were when we left the Hobbit Hole, up in the attic for the fox pelts, but that's really the only evidence other than the feeding stations. Time out. So where were we? We sailed out there, and we immediately fell in love with the place. And at the time, my brother and I were both going to, well, I guess my brother had finished college. It was 1973. And I had gone to college for a couple of years while I started college, and then at U of A in Fairbanks, and then I went to UAS in Juneau the second semester, and then the beginning of my sophomore year, I think I went back to Fairbanks for the first semester, and then the second semester, two or three of my friends, or, well, it was five of us, I guess, two vehicles, went to Mexico for a couple months and then to Hawaii and bicycled around Hawaii. And anyhow, then I came back from that and started buying fish. And then the discovery of the Hobbit Hole happened. So anyhow, we sailed out there and checked things out and decided that we wanted it or would like to buy it. And at the time, Fred had just finished college, so he didn't have any money, and I was going to college, so I didn't have any money. We each had a 10-speed bicycle and a 35-millimeter camera was our net worth, pretty much. So we went to my father to see if he'd go to the bank with us and countersign the loan, and he'd always invested in remote properties and rare deals, you know. Throughout our lives, he bought an island in Lake Vermilion in Minnesota before we were even born, after he got out of the service. And then we lived in Yellowstone. He bought a couple tax delinquent mining claims out of above Cook City in Yellowstone, outside of Yellowstone, for next to nothing. And so anyhow, it was something that he was didn't hesitate really to go in and countersign the loan with us at the B.M. Barron's Bank in Juneau, and when John Holmquist was the banker. And then we both had to make some money, and that was during the pipeline boom, 73. So we both went to Fairbanks and started going to the union halls at the laborers' union, and Fred got a job within a week. And I spent about 3 weeks going to union calls and wasn't getting calls, so I finally went to job service and got a job driving truck and warehousing for what at the time was Alaska Welding Supply, which one was along with, I can't remember the other welding supplier, gas supplier. Anyhow, I got a job with them, starting out as a truck driver flunky in the warehouse, and I ended up being the warehouse foreman after 2.5 years. And I worked for them for 2 years straight, or 2.5, and then I told them I had to go down and check out my investment in Southeast Alaska, so I took a summer off, and then I went back and worked one more winter. And they offered me the managership of the Prudhoe Bay store, and I had absolutely no interest in going to Prudhoe Bay and living in the dark for 6 months of the year, so came back to Southeast Alaska and bought a troller, and I had my hand troll permit since I was in high school, and started hand trolling, and then I bought a power troll permit as soon as I found one. And my brother also bought a troller and a power troll permit. In fact, he bought the first power troll permit that was sold after limited entry came into existence. And we both became trollers and had various boats over the years. And I got into doing a little bit of long lining also for halibut, and did that. And as a earlier in my life, what I guess it was after high school, during this period of time, before and after we bought the Hobbit Hole, I used to fish on the seine or the osprey for winter herring, which takes place in that fisheries usually in January. And I also had done some crabbing in the winter on the osprey, and would leave the Hobbit Hole when we had a, you know, with some sort of a caretaker, and do those fisheries in the winter time for a month or two. And sometimes the spring sacro fishery in Sitka, and actually had a plans to go to Prince William Sound the year of the big Exxon Valdez oil spill, and because I was on a boat that was going to go to Prince William Sound, I got a tiny little settlement as a crew person from the oil companies.
So, going back to when you were in the process of buying the Hobbit Hole, I was just wondering, what were you thinking when you sailed through the gut for the first time? Because you saw it from the air, but then seeing it right in the water.
Well, it just looked cooler and cooler and cooler. Like, this spot is amazing, you know. There's no place else like it.
What about
it?
It was
just perfect, you know. And it looked a little different than now, of course, because there wasn't the guest house and there wasn't Fred's house. And there were three big mountain ash trees in the front yard, which died of old age, and you can still see where they were if you knew where they were. But the house has been expanded some, so it's different, you know. And there wasn't the bridge, and there was just a float out at the pilings. There wasn't a ramp going up the beach, you know. And we just used a skiff on the outhaul to go back and forth to the dock. And there was a little bit of a net float out at the outer pilings, and those pilings, in fact, I think that, I don't know if Ward's Cove or Excursion Inlet has given up the title and leased those. I think they have. But back when we first bought the Hobbit Hole, they were still seining in the passes, and it was a very active and very lucrative fishery. And those floats and pilings out in front of the Hobbit Hole there was tenders tied up there and seiners anchored there, and there was seine skiffs running around all over the place, and it was a very busy and much more active place than it is now. And now there's no seining at all out there. Because one year they had a seine opening there, and it happened to be when the majority of the Northern Lynn Canal coho run was going through, and generally the seiners were targeting pinks and chums, but that happened to be an opening when there were a lot of coves going through, and it didn't decimate the Lynn Canal run, but it affected it for many years. And after that season, they stopped seining in the passes completely and moved it into Point Adolphus and further inside to save the resource. And it, you know, and they came back and it worked. And now they're much more, there's a lot more science involved now with the position and the length of the openings as far as seiners are concerned, because they can be so effective if there's a big part of a particular run in an area. They could easily not wipe it out, but cause considerable harm.
It sounds like you've lived in a lot of places of great natural beauty, like Yellowstone, and you've been to Hawaii and Mexico, but what do you think it is about the Hobbit Hole that was so special for you?
Well, I guess the solitude, and that's the one thing that I miss about the Hobbit Hole, is the solitude, but I'm also a very gregarious and social person, so but that's something that I miss, you know. But I don't miss the amount of work that it takes to maintain a place like the Hobbit Hole, and the firewood and the shoveling the snow and all of the things that you have to do depending upon what level of existence you want to have. And so, you know, it's a lot less work to be here in Gustavus.
Mm-hmm. And were there any traces of Tlingit occupancy?
Oh, yes. Well, there's a Tlingit grave site, which I'm sure you've seen, which is from 1901 or 1903 or something like that. And Wayne Howell, who's on the... he was on the board, I think he still is, who's a anthropologist, archaeologist, has done a little bit of looking around out there, and there's a that sort of plateau where the upper garden used to be up by the swing tree. He thinks that was man-made. If you look around there, it extends to more than just a garden. There's kind of a shelf mm-hmm. there. And over the years, we found a string of probably 50 or 60 Russian trade beads, which I think are still hanging there on the post, one at a time, you know, various places, and one was found with, in relatively recent time, I think within the last 20 years, just on the beach. Some lady was walking down the beach, and there it was. And Wayne also did a excavation across from the main house, across the yard, up on the hill there, and found a pounding stone. I can't remember how deep it was where he found that, but there's definitely lots of signs of previous occupation by the Tlingits. And as far as we know, the story is, anyhow, that was always a summer camp until the fox farm started. And when the fox farmers came, they chased the Tlingits off. And so that was the last time that they occupied it. But they still come out in the spring, particularly on the big minus tides, for kelp. And I had a number of friends from Hoona, particularly when we were first there, friendships that I developed from Hoona boys that came out to go hunting or to go fishing. And I went out and actually learned how to rod and reel fish for kings from one of the Mills boys. And so I had some good friends from Hoona in the earlier days, and went to college with a couple of Tlingits from Hoona, the Greenwalls and the Hinchmans.
And then you mentioned that the people you bought it from weren't fox farmers.
No, we bought it from Doug and Flo Freed, and I'm assuming that they bought it at the end of the fox farming era. And Doug was a troller, salmon troller, and Flo was his wife, and they had a gardener helper named John, as we understand the story. And John and Flo would stay there and garden and run the place in the summertime, and Doug would be off fishing, and he fished until he died in Latuya Bay of a heart attack. And anyhow, they were there about 30 years, about the same time, a little less than us. And they're the ones that put it on the market originally, probably in the, I'm going to say like 67, 68, something like that. And a fellow named Milton Brown in Juneau, who used to work for AJ Industries, and I think he trolled also. Anyhow, he bought it, and his wife was a school teacher, and they fantasized about living there in her teaching school, I think, in Elfin Cove. At that time, Elfin Cove still had a school. Anyhow, they came out there, and I think they, as we remember it, or as the story goes, they spent about a, I mean, I don't know if they lived there for a whole year or not, but they, you know, fixed things up, repainted the inside of the house, and did a lot of that kind of stuff. And then, as we understand it, the wife decided that she wasn't cut out for living that isolated kind of lifestyle. And commuting to Elfin Cove to be the school teacher wasn't going to be a very practical thing to do. So anyhow, then they put it on the market. And it was on the market for, I'd say, about 3 years, I think, before we found it.
And then you said that your father helped you purchase it?
Well, he countersigned the loan. Mm-hmm. And we paid him interest. Well, he made the down payment as well, and we paid back the down payment with interest, and then we paid the bank loan off, of course.
How much did you buy the Hobbit Hole for?
I probably shouldn't say this, but I will.
No,
a lot of people know. It was $30,000 in 1973.
Is that considered a good price?
I thought it was a great price. Mm-hmm. You know, and even though Zach paid $1 million, he got a great price too. Because all the, you know, we've added two buildings and the dock and the outer dock and, you know, the grounds and everything else, plus the value of a dollar has gone up considerably too, so. And there's no other place, there's no place like it in Southeast Alaska or any place. It's in a very unique location, and it will remain so.
So you mentioned your father a little bit, but I was wondering about your mother.
Well, she was a career librarian, and I can't remember if she did any librarian when we were in North Carolina. I was too young to remember that, but I know in Yellowstone she was a school librarian, I think, the whole time we were in Yellowstone. And then we moved to Alaska. She worked for the Forest Service in a paid librarian capacity. And I think she also organized and put together the first library at Bartlett Cove for the Park Service, but I believe that was a non-paid position. It was just something that she was interested in helping doing. And I don't think that she could have, would have been proper. But I don't know, she might have been getting paid. I don't think so at all. But neither here nor there. But anyhow, she was a career librarian.
And did she enjoy her work?
Oh, yes, very much. She would do it even if she wasn't getting paid. And I'm not so sure that she was getting paid when she did the school libraries in Yellowstone, or if it was more of a volunteer effort.
Do you think that affected you at all, having a mother who was a librarian growing up?
Oh, I'm sure it probably encouraged me to read, which I have always done all of my life. And at the Hobbit Hole, did a lot of reading in the wintertime in the long, cold, dark days with no TV or other exterior entertainment, no internet. None of those things that we have now.
No Facebook.
And as growing up, we had TV in Yellowstone. There was one channel that came from Idaho Falls, and there was a repeater up on Bunsen Peak. So we had TV in Yellowstone, but it was never... That's the only time in my life that I can remember having a TV and watching it on any kind of a regular basis. At the Hobbit Hole, we eventually got a TV and did Netflix and movies and stuff like that, but we got a dish for internet when that came along, but we never got a dish that was capable of doing TV other than what you can get over the internet, but we never watched it. We'd get, you know, Netflix and watch movies that way and stuff, but never any kind of regular TV. And when we first got there, there wasn't, well, it was before the public radio station, and Sitka had a repeater on Cape Spencer so we could get public radio after a few years. But the first few years we were there, there was no radio, and I ended up putting in a great big long wire antenna that I could pick up stations all over the United States anyhow and listen to the radio, because I've always been a sort of a news addict. I just like to know what's going on in the rest of the world, even though it has little effect on my life. And I'm still that way. Although it may have more effect on my life now than it ever did before, just because my life is different. And all of our lives are different. So we keep breeding, making more of us, and using the earth, not necessarily to our best advantage.
Have there been certain books or movies, radio programs that have been really important to you, either as a kid or now, or just in your life?
Oh, I wouldn't say there's anything that's really special, other than I'm definitely a public radio fan as opposed to a Fox News fan. And I've been a supporter of public radio for many years and will continue to be. And I like science programs. Although I'm not particularly into science books, I'm more into escape literature than history or science, as far as my reading is concerned.
What do you mean by escape literature?
Well, novels. Mm-hmm. Not anything that has any, something that you're just reading to enjoy it. That's a story, as opposed to facts. Mm-hmm. Like school books, History is okay, but once you've gone through high school and have a good history background, of course there's a lot more history than you learn in high school, but that's interesting too, but I don't find it interesting as far as reading is concerned.
Do you have any books that you find yourself returning to?
Only accidentally. Mm. Oh, I've read this 10 years ago or 15 years ago or something, the Mark Twain, the classics, and I can't name a particular one.
Earlier you mentioned a little bit about how our overpopulation and how we can wisely use our resources. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that, what your views on that are.
Well, just as far as the energy of this planet is concerned, and the damage that happens with oil in particular, is my big concern. And now that they're developing and having had a hydro system at the Hobbit Hole, now that they're, technology is advancing in as far as solar and hydro and wind, all of those things which are renewable and don't necessarily cause any problems, although big hydro projects certainly have in the past caused a lot of problems as far as salmon migrations and stuff like that. But they're gradually doing away with some of those hydro projects and replacing them with something more environmentally favorable. And like the hydro at the Hobbit Hole, I had, I was inspired by some notes that Doug Freed had left in the cabinet that we found, and who'd lived there for the 30 years prior to us. And he had been interested in hydro because Elfin Cove, from early in its beginning, had a hydro plant there. But it didn't run that much of the year. It was just dependent upon a lot of rain to run. In fact, the old turbine housing or the belt and wheel housing for the turbine that used to be in Elfin Cove is still there in the community center there where the playground is. Anyhow, his notes are what inspired me to do the hydro at the Hobbit Hole. And at the time he was investigating, which is now 60 years ago, small hydro did not exist. High head, low flow, or just, you know, the volume of water we had wasn't adequate for any of the systems that existed, except when there was a lot of flow. So anyhow, that inspired me, and I went up to where the existing cofferdam is on our little hydro system and saw, well, I'd been up and down the mountain a number of times, but I hadn't been thinking about hydro, and saw that where that source was where it was actually coming out of the side of the mountain. It wasn't after it had run down the mountain. It was where it was boiling out of the side of the mountain. So I suspected that it was artesian in its source, but not necessarily totally artesian. And so I spent an entire year, and I went up there every day with a stopwatch, and I had built a little dam with a pipe coming out of it, and had a 30-gallon drum up there, and I measured how long it took to fill that 30-gallon drum up. So I
every day
for an entire year to find out what our flow was, and it just happened to be a year when we didn't get down to the minimum flows, which I'm sure they're experiencing now. But with that data, I went to a company called Little Spokane Hydroelectric. It was an individual that had his own hydro system, got into it, and started building these hydro systems, and gave him my data, and we sized that system that we have there, the big system, which would produce 7.5 kW at max, and down to, I might have been able to go down to like 800 watts or something like that, but we found out after time that when we got down to the minimum flow, which was only 800 or 1,000 watts or something, that if a freezer and a refrigerator kicked on at the same time and you had some lights on, you'd be in a brownout situation, so it would shut the system down completely. So then I investigated getting the 24-volt system, which is direct current instead of alternating current, and then it feeds a bank of batteries and goes through an inverter. So when a freezer or something, when you switch on the little system in a freezer or something, it kick on, it'd take the energy it needs from the batteries, and then it'd shut off and the batteries would get recharged, and that's why we have the little system. And as I understand it, I haven't talked to anybody specifically, but I understand the new system they're putting in is all DC and going to have an inverter and hopefully a much larger bank of batteries than exists now for storage capacity. Otherwise, it's not going to be as miraculous as people think it might be, because the amount of electricity and the amount of water isn't going to change what can be produced by the amount of water.
And that's something that's also affected by the drought, right?
Certainly, because we found out over time that artesian source, and in fact, this is the worst drought there's been since the system has been installed, so I don't know what that flow rate has gotten to now. So it'll be interesting to see. But I think as long as it doesn't go dry, that there'll be always something. Because that mainstream above where the dam is, or even that little, where we take our head, that mainstream dries up in the summertime.
And so that mainstream comes from?
Further up the mountain.
Okay.
And I don't know if it's, if there's any artesian source to it, but if there must not be, because it dries up almost completely. Mm-hmm. And you've been up there recently, I'm sure, and there's probably not much water coming down in the creek above the dam. You know, and I thought, you know, the artesian source, it could be a crack in the mountain that comes all the way over from the lake. You know, some kind of a fracture that that water's getting through from the lake. But I don't know what the lake looks like this summer either, if it's down to, you know, if you can see any difference or if it's still up to the brim. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've been up there.
Right, I just haven't seen it before.
So you don't, you know, but you can go down and look and tell where the water level may have been.
What does artesian mean?
Ground from the, within the ground, like an artesian well is one that, artesian springs, springs that never stop.
Mm-hmm.
They aren't fed by rainwater necessarily. Well, I guess they're all fed by rainwater in some respect, but you know, there's springs everywhere that don't dry up.
So you were able to get the Hobbit Hole on hydro.
Mm-hmm.
And for the entire time you were there?
No, we went online in 85 and we bought it in 73. I was inspired and started, did the research and was having the turbine built and all that stuff, and then I decided, well, the pipeline's going to be going over Forest Service property. I better get a hold of the Forest Service and let them know what we're doing. So I wrote a letter to the Hoonah Ranger District, which we were part of, and told them what I planned to do, and they wrote back and said, that sounds like a great idea, and they sent me a special use permit to fill out for right away for the pipeline where it's over Forest Service property, which is about two-thirds of the pipeline. And as I was, before I had that application filled out and sent back to them, I got another letter from the Forest Service saying that they had received a directive from FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, not to issue any special use permits to small hydro developers until they'd secured their FERC permit. And I had already secured my water rights because they're state. And I'd put my ad in the Juneau Empire for a month or however long you're supposed to do it to notify, you know, to that you were going to use this water. And I got my state water rights. And anyhow, by the time I got the, I wrote away to FERC to get their application, hoping it would only be two pages like the Forest Service one was, but it wasn't. It was a book about an inch and a half thick, and you had to contact every single state and federal agency that exists, seemingly. And at that time, I ceased communication with either FERC or the United States Forest Service, and I already had the pipe on the beach because that's when I was still buying fish for Juneau Cold Storage, and we had a tender coming up from Seattle, so I bought the plastic pipe in Seattle, and I already had that there, and we got a bunch of cement and went about our business and put in the, had a fishing friend, Dennis Montgomery, who had a degree in engineering, and we figured out what we needed to do and did it. And we've been online since 85, and the Forest Service had sent, twice they sent crews out to survey the property line, but they hire private contractors to do that surveying. They're not Forest Service people, and they almost drove a survey stake through the pipeline when it was where it's underground, but not quite. But anyhow, they were well aware of the fact that we had the hydro, but they didn't say anything to the Forest Service, apparently. And then in more recent time, I got paranoid about the Forest Service finding out about it, so we decided to paint the pipe where it's above ground, so we got a bunch of that National Guard camouflage green color, kind of a light green color. And Jane and I, we drained the pipe so there wouldn't be any condensation, and we spent the day toweling off the pipe all the way up to the top and painting it. And at the 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we were coming back down the pipeline, and our dog alerted, started barking, and we walked out by the house, and here was three or four Forest Service guys walking down the float to the dock where their skiff was, and they waved, and we waved, and they kept on going. Since then, and since we sold it to the Institute, Zach has gotten a hold of the Forest Service, and I assume that the permitting process is going through or has gone through or anything else, because being in a wilderness area, it's much more, I mean, you don't want to be in a wilderness area and be listening to a diesel generator running all the time. So it's a much more, it's a good thing, and the forester should be promoting that and rather than trying to restrict it.
So this is the first time you've mentioned Jane in the interview. When does she come into your life?
Well, she came up with a friend in Gulf from, well, Peggy Montgomery, who now lives in Gull Cove with her husband in the summertime. Anyhow, her husband, Dennis, was another troller who we'd gotten to know, and he married Peg. And Peg and Jane were old friends from grade school, I think, but certainly through high school, but I think they'd known each other all their lives. And Jane came up to visit Peg. And that summer, Peg and Dennis were living in a float house on the beach at the Hobbit Hole. And another friend of theirs came up, Lorna Zlock. And anyhow, they came up, and I just was entertaining Jane and Laura, and we went on skiff rides and this and that, and we were still busy fishing and still had the communal dinners every night, so it was a busy place. And anyhow, Jane and I just hit it off, and she had to go back to Reno, I think at the end of a couple of weeks, and then she came back up for the end of the summer to fill in as the cook gardener, because the lady that was doing it was pregnant and had to go have her baby. And then she agreed to come back, and we got to I guess we fell in love, or we got intimate, and she decided to come back the next summer and be the cook gardener. And then after that summer, I guess that's when we went to Belize that we actually decided to get married, and the rest is history.
What about Jane attracted you?
Just her personality, just the way she was, nothing special, everything special, you know. Just a person that I just respected and liked, and she seemed to like me. I guess that was probably the main thing.
So this is during the period where, would you call it a fishing commune?
Well, some people use communes have the sometimes the feeling that everybody sharing wives and things like that, but it wasn't at all like that. The only thing that was communal about it was that it was a bunch of young people that had just started fishing, most of them, and rather than go to Elfin Cove, we became friends with these people that we fished with, and we shared fishing codes with, you know, to tell a person where the fish were at. You know, we had a code wheel that we developed that had sayings on it and dates and the number of fish you were catching or where you were, but all these things were in code. And you just turn the wheel. It had two discs, one on each side. I've got one here somewhere. You'd turn it to the date, and then there would be a phrase that corresponded to $300 to $500. And then there'd be another phrase that corresponded to your location, but it wasn't the location. And so you turn to the date, and you'd share these scores with there were 8 or 10 of us, you know, that had this. And there's lots of different fishing places, so it was a good thing to. And nowadays, of course, everybody's got cell phones, and so you don't have to do that. But anyhow, it's this group of young people, all relatively new trollers, and it was just a good time for us to get together and have a evening meal together and go to bed and get up at 3 in the morning and go fishing.
And this was, and so how many people would you have at once at the Hobbit Hole?
Oh, at most there might be 20 or 25 people for dinner or something, you know. And if you're having the 4th of July party or something like that, there would be, of course, more people, but, you know, people from Elfin Cove and so on.
And people just slept on their boats?
Yeah. Everybody slept on their boats, if their boats were big enough. I can't remember if there was any tent campers. Maybe Deborah, when she was first there, but before Bobo came along, she might have been camping, but... But she's probably the... She and Dennis Montgomery are the oldest old-timers that are still around, that are still fishing. Another good friend of mine in college, Ron Creer, deckhanded for me for a few years and was the gardener and built the rock garden in front of the house there, you know, and did a lot of those kind of things. And he fished with me at least 1 year, maybe 2 years. And he was an old college buddy. And then he eventually went back to college and finally finished his degree. And then he worked for the state until he retired in health and social services, and was like second man under the director when he retired, and could have pursued that if he wanted to, but he was ready to quit. And he married Dennis Montgomery's from Gull Cove's sister, Barb. Mm-hmm. After the Hobbit Hole time.
So for how many years, or it was just during the summer, right? That you had, that everyone came together?
Yeah, in the wintertime there was nobody there except me. And there was somebody there with me most of the time. Tim Akeley spent the first two or three winters there. I think Ronald might have spent part of one winter. Various people over the years. I was seldom there for very long, but I was there by myself for quite a few years.
So for how many summers did you have all these people coming over?
Well, pretty much until from 73 when we bought it. That first summer, 73, I was still buying fish. We had a good friend of my brother Fred's, Dan Kurtz and his wife from Montana came up and stayed there that summer because we were both fishing and they wanted to come and they ended up staying there. I don't remember if they did any gardening or what they did. They were just kind of house sitters. And then after that, as far as I can remember, I started living there full time, and Fred was there in the summers. He spent part of, I believe, the first winter after we bought it. I think he might have spent part of that winter there. And then from then on, he spent his winters in Irondale, Port Townsend area. Roughly split 6 months, both places. And he had a number of boats during his fishing career, including building a sailboat troller, the Dryas, during that period. And he had the Amely L. before the Dryas. I'm trying to remember if he had the... I guess he had the Venture, but I can't remember for sure. And he had several boats in his fishing career. I assume you're interviewing him, too?
So, when you and Fred decided to stay together at the Hobbit Hole, what did that conversation look like?
just decided to do it as brothers, and we didn't even think about it. I mean, and then I ended up living in the house because I stayed there all year long. And I can't remember if he started living in a wall tent that very, or the second summer, because neither one of us were really staying there the first summer. We were busy fishing. Actually, I was still buying fish at that time, and I guess Fred was fishing and just staying on his boat. And then it just became apparent that I was going to be the one that was living there all the time, and so I just got the house. And he could have lived upstairs in the warehouse, but he chose to live in a wall tent, and he lived in a wall tent up where his house is for, I believe, at least 2 years, maybe 3 years before he built his house.
Did you two interact very often?
Pardon me?
Did you two interact very often?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Every day. Fishing, you know. Where you going? How'd you do? Yeah. All the time.
And was... Did you ever feel...
And he was at dinner, you know. Mm-hmm. He was one of the gang.
Did it ever feel, I guess, overwhelming to have all these people over all the time?
Well, it got to be overwhelming. Once Jane and I decided to get married, then it was definitely not, you know, it was time to end. And we did. And we'd still have get together potlucks on a regular basis, you know. So it was still got the social life, and Jane just created a lot more social life. As being someone who's there all day long and not somebody that's out fishing for 18 hours a day or out anchored up and gone for a week and so on and so forth, you know. So her friends would come and visit and so on. And she, of course, got involved with, you know, learned how to drive boats and all that stuff because she came from the desert and had absolutely zero experience in any kind of that activity. And she learned to be a very competent mariner.
Did she ever go fishing with you?
I don't think she ever went with me fishing. Maybe once, but not that I can remember. I know she went out fishing with Dennis and Peg. I think that was before we got married, when it may have been the first time she came up to visit Peg. She might have gone out with Dennis and Peg on the LA-4, but she was definitely not interested in the blood and the slime and the whole show. But my friend Kim Nay, who was a partner of mine at the Hobbit Hole for 2 or 3 years, who was responsible for building the guest house, which was originally going to be her ceramic studio, and that's those big windows when you first walk in, was where her wheel was going to be there, so she could sit there on her wheel and look out the window, you know. But after building that studio, and it was just we decided that we weren't meant to, or Kim decided that she didn't want to live there for the rest of her life or whatever happened, you know. And anyhow, then Jane and I got together and decided to turn it into a guest house, and built the back bedroom and the bathroom on the back, and put the stairs into the loft, which used to just have a ladder going up to it, and turned it into the guest house, more for personal guests than for paying clientele. And then we gradually worked into accepting paying clientele, And at first it was friends or friends of friends. Some of them wanted to go fishing, but I wasn't into taking people fishing, so we would arrange for them to go fishing with one of the charter operations from Elfin Cove and just stay with us at the Hobbit Hole. And then there was a year or two of leaner fishing, and we decided we should pursue the guest house business a little more aggressively. And Jane by then had enough sea time to get her master's license and could take people out whale watching and do things like that, but we still didn't pursue the fishing business at all. But what we have, like you say, we had friends or people that would contact our website and be interested in fishing, so we would arrange that for them. And then we had the kayak groups from Gustavus here, Spirit Walkers in particular, would come and stay with us and do a lodge-to-lodge kayaking trip where they'd stay with us, and then they'd go stay with a lodge in Elfin Cove and do that kind of thing. But we were never very good at marketing, and fishing was making enough of a living so we weren't under pressure to, you know, to pursue the guest house business more than we did. And I was fishing most of the time, so, you know, if I was fishing locally in Cross Sound, I could be home and help with dinner, but, you know, I was ready to go to bed because I was getting up at 3 in the morning or 4 in the morning to go fishing, so I wasn't much help other than telling stories, barbecuing the fish.
I want to ask you more about that, but do you mind if we take a few minute break?
Not at all. Pause. It's up to you.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you more about fishing, because last you were talking about like getting up at 3 in the morning. So could you describe sort of, I don't know if you have a typical day, but...
Well, of course I fished all year long. Mm-hmm. And in the wintertime, I just rod and reel fish for king salmon. In the summertime, I power trolls with the power troller with the big steel wires and lots of gear in the water. But the thing about fish, whether it's, I think probably even in rivers, but they bite at certain times. And one of the times it's the most assured, if there's any fish around, is at the crack of dawn. When the sun first shines.
And what time is
it? And they're hungry. Well, in the summertime, it's about 3:30. 3:30 to 4 o'clock. And I like to, you know, in the June and July, the longest days of the year, I like to have my gear in the water no later than 4, preferably a quarter to 4, 3:30, quarter to 4, when it's still just light enough to see what you're doing, you know. And sometimes you'd make your whole day in the first 3 or 4 hours of the day, or the bulk of your day. Just depends, you know, a very lot. And of course, the next best time are tide changes, or either side of a tide change, and depending upon where you are at the very end of the flood, is usually a good time when the current's starting to slack off, and then at the end of the ebb, some places where it's just starting to flood, you know, a new batch of fish will come in, or there'll be a slack water period and the feed will come up off the bottom, or for various reasons, either side of tide changes and the end of the flood seem to be the best times, and the early morning, and of course right before dark is also a good time. And when it's daylight for 20 hours, that doesn't give you much time to sleep. So when I first started fishing and was, I won't say deep in debt, but in debt for my power troll permit and my boat, I was driven and would fish black to black, as they say, which only gives you about 4 hours of sleep, which is not very much. But as I reduced my debt load, and you know, it depends. Like for king salmon fishing, after we were involved in a treaty and had a quota, and king salmon season only lasted part of the summer, then you'd fish hard during that opening or during that period of time. And then after that, I would not be fishing quite so hard. And if I was fishing in Cross Sound right in front of the house, where I spent most of my time, I would always be out for the early morning bite, but I would usually quit by 5 or 6 in the evening and have time to sell my fish and come home and have dinner and be in bed by 9 o'clock and get my 6 hours of sleep.
Did you have a routine when you were getting up really early? Like...
Oh, every day the same old thing. Mm-hmm. And you don't, you know, you wake up automatically, you know, or I did anyhow.
Or you didn't have an alarm.
Well, I had one, but it seldom was what woke me up. And it's hard work. If you want to do well, you have to put in your time. Catching fish isn't that hard. The important thing is to have your gear in the water. But you can't catch them if you're tied up at the dock.
What do you think makes a, like, hard work, but what else do you think makes a successful fisherman?
Basically, hard work is the key. And, you know, just, you know, trolling your electrical aura as you're driving through your water. Your lines that are down the water are steel waters, and they have voltage. And you just want a slightly positive voltage. You don't want a negative voltage or a real high voltage, or you won't catch beans. So there's a lot of little things that, and you know, there's always people that catch more than other people. And there's just little tricks with your gear and all those things. Many different variables, at least as far as trolling is concerned.
Can you remember any particularly good or bad days that you had?
Oh, yeah. Certainly.
Any ones that...
And most of them were days where I was in a spot where there was lots of fish and not very many boats. So there's no competition, and there'll be a spot on the drag, as they call it, where you're fishing, where the fish will be concentrated lots of times, you know, instead of just a big area where you can go anywhere and catch. You know, there's a hot spot if you're fishing in the passes where the tides are running. There's the right spot in the rip and be the first boat in line and all those things. There's many variables like that.
So when did you, are you still fishing now?
I still have my hand trawl permit, but here in Gustavus it's so hard to, since there's not a public dock facility here that you can leave your boat at where you can go anytime you want, it makes it real difficult. And I'm not inspired to, you know, I spent 40 years on the water fishing and I'm done. I mean, I'm not... I wouldn't mind going out and catching a king salmon or two just to eat, but as far as the doing it for money, I just really don't have much interest in doing that anymore.
I also wanted to ask you if you had any favorite stories from the Hobbit Hole.
Oh, God. I don't. I think, you know, we had a really big 4th of July one year. A friend from Fairbanks that had a powderman's license or something that allowed him to buy a lot of the fireworks that normal people can't buy. That was a pretty exciting time. We had mortars set up all the way around the Hobbit Hole, and it was like a, you know, a fireworks display that you'd see in a big city. Smaller, but, you know, it was pretty impressive, but... No, there was just so many good things. It's hard to pinpoint anything specific.
Well, if they come to mind,
yeah. I'm afraid of. You know, we'd have a 4th of July get together every year, and we'd have a talent show, which was always fun, and people would do different things. And I can't remember anything that I ever did, but I must have done something. Silence.
Silence is good too. Favorite stories, favorite spots at the Hobbit Hole, favorite places that you like to go to?
Well, Magic Beach has always been a favorite, and I'm sure you've been there many times. And actually, Eagle Crest is my favorite place to go. Or the top of the island when you get up above the lake and you can see everywhere. I like going up there, and I haven't done that for a number of years, but I used to do it regularly. I used to go up to, not to the lake, but up to the, where you start to go across to the lake, you know. I used to go up there every morning for my physical activity in the winter times.
Every morning to the top?
To the, not to the top, but to where you have to, where you have to go through the alders that first time, that's almost at the top. I'm sure you've been there. I'd go up that to that hump. And I used to go up there hunting a lot, and towards Middle Pass hunting was my preferred spot. And I used to do a lot of hunting. And as I got older and wiser, I did most of my hunting on the beach at prime time. There was lots of snow and low tide, and spot a deer and go into the beach with a skiff downwind and stalk up to within 50 yards or so and shoot them in the head and not have to worry about chasing them or any of that other stuff and not ruin any meat or anything like that.
What sort of things did you eat when you were living at the Hobbit Hole?
Fish and rice, venison and rice. And, you know, when somebody would go to town or you'd go to town or something, you'd have fresh produce. And always had frozen veggies in the freezer. So we'd have veggies, you know, but...
From the garden or from...
Well, both. Mm-hmm. We used to put up... broccoli is the one thing that I can remember mostly that we put up in the freezer. That's probably about it. And then we had a, you know, the root shelf there where we'd have our potatoes and carrots, and we grew enough potatoes to last through the winter most of the time.
Would you say you lived pretty much off the land?
In
the sea?
Oh. I would say over 50%. But, you know, we bought flour and fruit and canned goods and, you know, can of beans and bag of beans and, you know, we bought a lot of stuff. And in the younger days, it was more off the land, you know, more fish and rice or venison, deer and potatoes. And we used to be able to get a lot of Dungeness crab. In fact, you could fill a dungy pot inside the Hobbit Hole in an overnight soak. You could get...
Really?
20 crabs inside the Hobbit Hole. But then when the sea otters were introduced, thanks to my father and the National Park Service, and their first introduction to Southeast Alaska from the Aleutians was to Cape Spencer, the first time that they did a transplant. And I can't remember if it was 30 animals or what it was, but they flew into the Gustavus Airport in a big old Hercules, and then they flew them out to Cape Spencer in a, it seems to me it was a PBY, but it might have been a Grumman Goose, but the old amphib planes that used to fly a lot here in Southeast, and let the first batch loose there, and then it was either the next year or the year after they netted, did another bunch at Surge Bay, which is on the other side of Cross Sound South. And then I think they did a third one down in Southern Southeast a couple years later after that. And those small introductions of, like I say, it seemed like it was 30 the first time, but it might have been more than that. But have now grown considerably. And, of course, they're all part of the system, and they existed historically. But there weren't as many of us humans here, depending upon the resource. So it'll be interesting to see. I think that they've made a sufficient comeback now that they should start allowing individuals to harvest maybe just one a year or something, you know, as opposed to instead of just the Tlingits, which can harvest as many as they want as long as they do something with them. Which I think is good, but they're not keeping up with the resource. They're not taking near as many as they could without damaging the resource. And as a supreme predator, us humans should be able to figure out a way that everything can exist and get along and not wipe out anything. As the sea otters are wiping out the crab, except in places where they haven't gone all the way inside waters yet, because they just don't do that, but they may eventually, just because they may have to go there for food. Or in places like Port Frederick, which is right next to a Tlingit village, so the Indians keep the sea otter population down, so there's still a healthy crab population.
But were you talking about harvesting sea otters or crabs?
Well, you're talking about harvesting sea otters, so you can harvest crab now. You used to be able to harvest all the crab you wanted to because the otters weren't getting them all. And now the otters, and particularly in icy straits and any place near the coast, up and down the coast where the otter population has expanded, you know, in Lynn Canal and around Juneau, the otters don't go in that far because they're not, that's just not their nature. And whether they will continue to expand that way remains to be seen. But if they exhaust the resource here completely, you know, they're not eating as much crab as they'd like to. And if they get to the point where there's nothing else for them to eat, they will move to where there's some crab, I'm sure, or something.
Have you noticed any other changes in either sea life or just wildlife in the area?
In this area, I've noticed it particularly, but not necessarily at the island. The only thing that we have there, really, as far as a substantial population, is deer, and that fluctuates with the... It's mostly with the severity of the winter and how much winter kill there is. I don't think that hunting pressure has much to do with the population dynamic, at least around Elfin Cove and Indian Islands, just because there isn't that much outside pressure. But of course, here in Gustavus, I've seen a big change. When we first moved here, there were no moose here in Gustavus, and they came down the Chilkat Peninsula and went across Adams Inlet into Glacier Bay, and then continued to move down the Chilkat Peninsula and eventually came here to Gustavus, and their population did very well until the wolf population caught up with them. And just like any predator-prey relationship, the prey expands and expands, and the predators show up, and then the predators start eating the prey, and then their population expands, and then they run out of prey, and then they start going downhill. Like on Pleasant Island, used to be fully loaded with deer, but then the wolves, which came in after the moose, they got done eating all the moose, or not all of them, but they needed some more to eat, so they swam out to Pleasant Island, and then they wiped out all the deer on Pleasant Island. And they have even, Greg Streveler, I don't know if you've met or not, but he's was a biologist here at the park when we first came in 1966, actually, and used to hunt deer on Pleasant Island every year. And he was out there this last year and found some wolf scat that had sea otter fur in the wolf scat. And sea otters don't haul out very often, but they do. But once they're on the beach, they don't move very fast at all, so it'd be easy prey for a wolf. But there's not enough of them. I don't think enough of them haul out to support the wolf population. And I suppose the wolf population is going to start coming back over here and continue to decimate the moose population. So who knows?
What about fish populations?
Well, that's highly variable, mm-hmm. and I've seen some good years and some bad years in my many years of fishing. And I'm glad I'm not a fisherman anymore. And from what I can see, this is not shaping up to be a very good year in Southeast Alaska for the trollers or the seiners or the gillnetters, but that all remains to be seen. And something that I don't know if there's been enough emphasis placed on it or not is the competition with hatchery-produced fish and natural run fish. And back when they first started doing hatcheries here in Southeast Alaska, I was involved with the Elfin Cove Fish and Game Advisory Committee, which there are committees in all little communities. I believe Gustavus shares one with Hoonah. And these advisory committees are made up of individuals that live in towns, various users, commercial, sport, etc. And they send recommendations to the Board of Fisheries meetings. And back when all these hatcheries started developing here in Southeast, we made a proposal from the Elfin Cove Advisory Committee to just stand down a little bit until they see how this is going to affect natural stocks, the big production of hatchery fish competing with natural stocks. You don't want to wipe out the natural stocks. So that hasn't really happened, and they keep producing more and more hatchery fish, and I don't know if there's been any. I know there's people that have been concerned in Prince William Sound that the hatchery production may be harming the natural production, but it's a balance that may not be in balance. You know, there's an optimum number of species that the ocean can support. And of course the ocean acidification and all of those things are things that scientists don't have a very good grasp on. It's like it's hard to anticipate the actions the things that we're doing, how they're going to affect things. And like, you know, the plastic, now that they find microplastics in the deepest trench in the ocean, you know, and it's not going to go away.
The man that just dove down, right? He found a plastic bag at the bottom.
So we'll see. And it's like, you know, we're probably eating plastic every day, even if it's in a organic ocean caught salmon. You know, it probably ate some microplastics.
So, you mentioned you sold your boat. Do you remember what year that was?
Well, I've sold a couple of boats over the years.
Or the most recent.
But the most recent one was probably about 10 years ago. I guess we were talking about that, and I couldn't remember what year I sold it.
Which boat was that?
That was the Kita, which is the boat that I had most of my power troll career. My first boat was the... Well, we both started out, my brother and I, hand trolling on our family sailboat, which is the boat that we went on our discovery voyage to the Hobbit Hole, and we've since given that to Eric Cyrene, who lives here in Gustavus. And it's down on the beach in the harbor. If you go to the inner boat harbor, it's a bilge keel, so it can sit on the beach. Got two keels. Anyhow, we both started hand trolling with that, and then I can't remember if the Amelie L, I think, was my brother's first boat, and my first boat was the Quest. And I just outgrew it. It didn't have the capacity for the number of fish I was catching. It was just too small. And I just wanted a bigger boat, more comfortable, better, you know, fish in tougher weather and all those things, you know.
So you would come back to the Hobbit Hole for dinner and to sleep?
When I was fishing in Cross Sound, but like where the king salmon opening, I'd be out on the outside coast, and there wasn't time to, you know, when you're 4 hours away from home, there's not time to do that twice a day, you know, or running 2 or 3 hours, you know. If you're going to be there for that morning bite, so then you ice your fish, and there are fish buyers that are stationed up and down the coast, so you can go to a fish buyer without having to run for more than an hour, generally, and sell your fish and get more ice. And
how long would you be out there? For like how many days?
Seldom more than probably 5 or 6 days would be the most. And I'd go back for fuel and go home for groceries and shower and those things.
So, I guess describe to me what it was like deciding to sell the Hobbit Hole. Because you mentioned that it just became a lot of work.
Well, it was always a lot of work, but I never got any younger. And it just got to be, you know, we could have lived there for a while longer, but I wasn't fishing anymore. And I really didn't want to, or we collectively didn't really want to, continue to pursue the guest house business, because that's a lot of work too.
We meaning you and
Jane, yeah. And Fred was to the point where he never spent a winter there except part of the first winter. He bought a place in down outside of Port Townsend and spent his winters there. And in the wintertime, it's a desolate place. I mean, there's Jane Button. There's, you know, it's just lonely. And Jane definitely wasn't into it, and I wasn't either. Just, you know, I was tired of shoveling stone and splitting wood and all of those things that you have to do. And, you know, what's going on now, you don't get a grasp of that because you've got a whole bunch of people that are splitting wood and gardening. But in the wintertime, there's not going to be a whole bunch of people there to shovel the snow, and that just depends upon how much. But if you've got your boats tied up to the dock, you have to be able to go check your boat, so you got to shovel the snow to get there, and, you know, it's just a lot of work. And when you've done it for 40 years, you get tired of it.
And you and, I guess, Fred were the only ones doing it.
Well, Fred was never there in the wintertime, so he never had to worry about getting firewood or anything for me to burn. And I had help from the gang when there were still lots of us staying there, you know, or when it was more of the communal style. But after that, it was pretty much me as far as firewood, and I would spend the basically the month of October. I focused on firewood, and I'd go fishing, you know, at prime time, and evenings or at tide change or something like that, if I could catch a couple of king salmon and send them into town on the airplane and get top dollar from the grocery stores. But, you know, I'd spend basically that month beach logging and cutting firewood every day for 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. And then, so what was the actual process of selling the Hobbit Hole like?
Well, we listed it with a realtor for, and I think Jane told you that story, how Zach met our realtor on the Goonberry Trail here and found out that it was for sale, and he immediately expressed an interest. And the realty company, which a name I can't remember, was associated with a Mike Race Realty in Juneau, the same parent company. So it was essentially listed here and on their website. And we had some interest, but nothing very serious. And then Zach became seriously interested and had to have an appraisal as a nonprofit. And the appraisal came out considerably less than what we were asking. And we had one other cash offer, but it was somebody that was going to turn it into was actually an ex-deckhand who got involved with some rich girl, and she had the money, and they were ready to write us a check, but they were going to turn it into a lodge, you know, and we just didn't want to do that. You know, we wanted to sell it to either another fisherman or somebody like Zach, which we didn't know about or think about until Zach showed up with the idea of what he was going to do, or to some eccentric with lots of money that wasn't going to go in and get involved in a extractive resource, although we were commercial fishermen and extracting as the people's resource. And I just don't like the idea of, I think charter fishing is fine, you know, it's the people's fish and you have a right to come and get some of that. But when I see people taking boxes and boxes of fish out that I know they can't possibly eat that much, because you don't eat that much when you live here and have access to it all the time. So you're either selling it, which is competing with commercial fishermen who are providing the resource to the public, because everybody can afford to go into Safeway or Costco or wherever it is and buy a piece of fish once a month or once a week or once a year, whatever their desire is. But most common people can't afford to spend $5,000 or $10,000 to come to Alaska and catch some fish. And if they can and they take home more than they're going to eat, that means they're selling it on the black market or throwing it away at the end of the year when it's time to go again. So it's just not good. You know, they should be restricted as far as the volume that they can take. And that's coming. It's just a process.
Are there more people like that coming over here now?
Oh, way more. Well, Elfin Cove didn't used to have any lodges when I first moved there. Mm-hmm. And now it has three or four. One of them has, it's a self-guided, which have not as restrictive bag limits. And he has, I think I heard he has 16 boats this year. One lodge. And there's other lodges that are guided that have they each have at least 5 or 6 boats that are taking up to 5 or 6 people on each one of those boats. and they let them take home. Well, some of them don't have any limits. Some of them have a 50-pound. You take home a 50-pound wetlock box full of fillets, and that's reasonable.
And that's not to mention all the cruise ships that are coming by now, too.
Well, yes, but they're, other than the, well, they have been caught dumping their sewage, which is a problem, and their exhaust is a problem. But I have to come back to, and my father, and as far as Glacier Bay, was somewhat not responsible for it, but encouraged the cruise industry, because a part of the national park philosophy is to, it's for the people, so it's making it available to the most people with the least impact, which a cruise boat does, particularly in Glacier Bay, as opposed to 10,000 kayakers going up and camping on the beach and leaving their plastic or whatever, you know, if that were to happen. A cruise boat up and back, and all they're basically doing, unless they pump out their sewage, is polluting the air. And that will get better, hopefully, before it gets worse. But, you know, we keep making more people. And things will come to a head eventually.
When did your father retire?
Oh, God, I can't remember. Can't remember when he died. Must have been in the, about the Hobbit Hall in 73. I'm going to say it was in the late 70s. Not positive, but like 77.
But he got to see the Hobbit Hall.
Oh, yeah. He was out there many times. Yes, he and Bill Brown used to come out every once in a while. He was there. We used to, after my mother died, we buried her ashes out at the point. When you go out to the gut there, back in the willows there. Mm-hmm. And we used to have a Remembrance Day celebration every year for her. And then it became a Remembrance Day for anybody. And our friends and friends of their friends who had passed and so on and so forth. And Bill and Bob used to always come out for that. And Carolyn. And there's still a marker out there in the bushes. If you go out to the point where all the pets are buried out there too, there's some big piles of rocks that are in various places out there that mark pet graves. Anyhow, back in the alders there, where you can look out to the pilings up above the tide line, just back into the woods, there's a round marker that a friend of mine made for my, I don't remember if there's one for my father there and my mother, or there. Some of their ashes. I think it's just my mom's ashes.
Was it her decision to have her ashes there?
Yes. She wanted to be with the with the boys, and we picked that spot so she could watch us come in and out of the gut at the end of the fishing day.
And I heard your parents used to host happy hours every Friday.
My father, I don't think he did it when my mother was alive, but he used to host How Hour on Friday nights, and he had his various old-timer friends. It was mostly just a bunch of old guys. Not a bunch, but four or five people. Bill Brown and other old Parksers people and other old Gustavites. And he found out what each of them liked to drink, and he'd have whatever it was that they liked. And every Friday night, they'd have how hour, and they'd come over and tell stories and have a drink or two, and then they'd go home. And he didn't start doing that until after my mother died, if I recall. And then when he died, Bill Brown, who was one of the regulars at How Hour, started doing it at his house. And I think that maybe Bill was doing it in the winters and Mary was doing it in the summers, because I can't remember when. Bill didn't die until after Mary. If Bill took it over after Mary, that may be what happened. Anyhow, it was a tradition here in Gustavus for a few years. And when we started coming back, or when we decided that we were going to sell the Hobbit Hole and retire and live here, we had some friends here in Gustavus, Bruce and Colleen Smith Stansbury's, who I'd known forever, liked to go out to Hobbit Hole for the month of November to get their deer, and they would go out there and do their hunting, and we would come and stay here, and we started doing How Hour again for the month that we were here. And one year we stayed actually through Christmas. They came out at Thanksgiving, and we'd stay through December and then go back when the weather permitted the exchange. And now last year they went to Gull Cove, where Dennis and Peg are in the summer, because Zach now has a full-time, we hope, how's Coulter's hernia doing? Is he going to go get it taken care of?
He's getting surgery this September. And then he's going to stay in Tenneke with Molly and Nick afterwards to recover. But yeah, he's definitely lifting more than he should.
Yeah. Well, he should just go get it taken care of. But I guess the recovery is a consideration too.
But that's the thing about living at the Hobbit Hole, right? It is so much work.
Yeah, exactly.
Every day.
Never ends. So you can imagine how it was when it was just me. Or me and Jane, but you know.
Yeah.
And of course, he's creating a lot of work as far as upgrades and changes and stuff too, but just the day-to-day living, I mean, you know, tending the garden, mowing the lawn, cutting firewood, and shoveling snow in the wintertime, it's not the easy life.
So
it's a good life.
What was it like to transition from the Hobbit Hole to, I guess, your life here and now?
Easy street. You know, if you get a lot of snow, you just call the plow truck and he comes and takes care of it. And if you're cold, you turn up the thermostat, turn on the light switch, and pay your bill. And we didn't burn hardly any wood this last year because we wanted to get a grasp of our fuel consumption for a year without burning any wood. So we had an idea for as far as budgets are concerned. And it seems like this house is super well insulated, so it's really easy to heat and maintain. But we'll burn more wood this winter, as long as I've got some. And it seems to be pretty readily available here. You can just call a guy up and tell him you want a cord and give him a couple $100 and you're good to go.
Do you feel like you lose any of the satisfaction of doing it yourself?
No. I mean, I'll still have to work with, even if I have somebody else, even if I buy my wood, I still got to stack it and haul it in and feed the fire and do those things. But no, I've done it long enough. I feel some satisfaction about having worked hard enough and frugally enough so I have enough money to do whatever I want to do within reason and not have to go out and cut my own firewood. But even if you go out and cut your own firewood, you still got to burn gas to run your chainsaw and all those other things and do the labor. And I don't know, is Zach using the log splitter or is he splitting by hand? Or have you been doing any?
I split some logs. No, we have a log splitter.
Yeah, we left our log splitter there.
I remember someone was using it at the work party.
Yeah, that's the way to go. When we first bought the Hobbit Hole, there's a couple of big crosscut saws. Mm-hmm. We used to have when there was, you know, the communal style lifestyle in the fall. That's one of the things that people would help me do was to cut wood. And we'd go get beech logs and had a sawbuck and saw the logs by hand. And then I split by hand with a wedge and a maul for years before I got a log splitter. And that was really demanding.
When's the last time you were back at the Hobbit Hole?
Oh, we were there at the... Seems like we were there at the beginning of the summer. Time flies. Yeah, we stopped in there for something after this spring when after Coulter and Lexi were there. I was disappointed to hear that Lexi was leaving, but I guess that happens. Wasn't meant to be, apparently. Hopefully Coulter will find another companion. Because living there by yourself is challenging. But I expect Zach will spend quite a bit of time out there off and on for the winter, during the winter. And I have no idea if he has any groups planned for the winter time, but it's just the getting back and forth can be very challenging there. I've seen it winter time, 3 weeks once when no planes, nothing. You get back and forth in a big boat, but when it was blowing northerly gales and freezing spray and those things where there's no airplane to Elfin Cove for over 3 weeks with the mail because of the weather. So it can be pretty isolated. You don't really realize that in the summertime.
Because there, and especially now when there's so many groups just coming in and out.
Yeah. And it will be what it will be, but I'm a little bit concerned that Zach has too many big groups of people, you know. Should restrict his groups to like 10 people or something, you know. Just because it affects the experience, and it's also going to affect the whole trip, you know. Hundreds of people going up and down the mountain, and the trails and the, all of those things.
Have you been able to interact with any of the student groups?
Just when we were there, there were a couple. You know, we did the, what was it, the Stanford sophomore, the ones that go to Sitka and...
Oh, the Stanford sophomore college.
Yeah, we did that twice before we left, you know.
Oh.
And a couple other groups, and Jesse had a yoga retreat there when we were still there. Because it was, a, you know, it's a process. I think it was like 3 years that, after we made the deal that we were still there, two summers for sure, when Zach had groups coming, you know.
Were those 3 years just you and Jane and Fred getting ready to move out?
And Fred kept his boat until, for a few years after me, and was still fishing, sort of. In fact, he just sold it it was the year before last, I guess, while we were still there.
I'm curious what you think about, like, what Indian is trying to do at the Hobbit Hole.
Well, I think it's excellent, and that's why we... one of the reasons that we were happy that Zach did it. Because it can't hurt, and it can only be good as far as the future of the Earth is concerned. And I hope it has some impact, that enough of the right people get there who are strong believers in making some changes and do it, and not just talk about it.
Before we end, is there anything else that you like to talk about or that you didn't get to?
Oh, I'm sure there's a whole bunch of things that we didn't get to. But there's nothing in particular that I need to say.
In that case, thank you very much then.
You're welcome. Now you can start going through all those photo albums.